I want to say a special thank you to Chris Whalen, who is in the back of the room trying to figure out who's here. And if you would wear name tags, you would make her job so much easier. And if you wore name tags, you would make my job so much easier. And you would know each other a little better. And if you don't have a name tag, you should just ask. And start by asking me or asking Barbara when she's here. I also want to thank the folks who are sitting on the front row. When you sit on the front row, it makes more room for the people in the back row who just will not sit on the front row. And now, I've looked, and we're about 30 lessons into our study of going through the Bible, and we're about 35 chapters in. So we're averaging slightly better than one chapter a week. Maybe that's good. We finished last time looking closely at chapters 34 and 35, getting ready to look at chapter 36, all this in Genesis, looking closely at 34 and 35, getting ready to look at 36, noting that the whole of chapter 36, which we haven't looked in detail yet, but the whole of chapter 36 is devoted to a look at Esau and what's happened with Esau and what happens with his descendants. Chapter 37 begins the story of Joseph, and we're trying to get there as quick as we can. I do want to note that chapter 35 ends with Jacob coming home at last to where Isaac is, and that Isaac died and Esau and Jacob came together to bury him. The whole of chapter 36 ends with a punctuation mark, and the punctuation mark is either the first verse of chapter 37 or the last verse of chapter 36. In my translation, it starts with the word "but." But Jacob settled in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan.
Now.
Okay. The contrast is being drawn between Esau and Jacob. And it's a very interesting contrast. If you read through this chapter, it's a chapter of all the chapters in the Bible. This one has more names in it, I think, than almost any other. And it's tough going. If you try to slog through here, it's tough going. But I want to do a couple of sort of highlights with you. In this record, the separation of Esau to Seir, his movement to Seir, is attributed to there not being enough room in Canaan for Jacob and Esau both. And yet we already know that Esau was in Seir already when Jacob returned from being with Laban. Okay, so it looks like there might be a little bit of a conflict with that. Let me remind you, everything Isaac had was Jacob's. Jacob was going to come home and take it and take over it. And that is what happened. The sense that there's not enough room for both, it may have been Isaac who was overseeing it, but it was Esau's goods and so forth that were there. So I don't know that there's necessarily a conflict. All that Isaac had was going to be Jacob's because of the things that had happened. We have a pop quiz that we have to have this morning to make sure everybody's on board. Isaac has two sons. What are their names? Esau and Jacob. Okay. What do we know about Esau? Rough and hairy. Rough and hairy. And when days go by sufficiently, we find him living in a place called Seir. What does that name mean? Rough and hairy. Interesting how these names take place. Jacob becomes, it's going to take a while before it happens, but his family becomes a nation. What's the name of that nation? Why is it called Israel? Because God changed Jacob's name to Israel. And so Israel becomes both the new name that Jacob has and the name of the country that comes from that. Were you in the 8 o'clock service? Did you hear the pastor read? Did you hear him read scripture? Did you hear the verse that said, "I am the God of Jacob"? Did you hear that verse? Whatever else it says, isn't it interesting that so often when the Bible says, God speaks to Moses, and he says to Moses, I want you to go to Egypt. And Moses says, if I get there, they're going to ask me who sent me. I don't even know your name. What's your name? He says, my name is I Am. And then he adds, I am the God of Abraham. I am the God of Isaac. I am the God of Jacob. You would think he would have said Joseph. We're about to enter the story of Joseph, one of the most Christ-like people in the Bible early on. He didn't say Joseph. You would have thought at least he would have said Israel, to say, I'm the God of the people who have changed. But he doesn't. He says Jacob. And so often the Bible says that, every time reminding us that God accepts us where we are and then leads us where he wants to go. So, the name Israel is the country that comes from here. Now, Seir changes its name. And the Bible is at pains across this part of Scripture to make sure you're ready for that. What's the name of the country that as it's changed? So why was it called Seir? Turns out there's a guy named Seir. He was a Hittite, and in chapter 36, you will read about him. As you scan through the names, keep an eye out for that. This was the original country before Esau came into it. Took its name from a leader. You have a sense of either deposing, probably not, or they would have told us about battles, or an intermarriage where Esau and his descendants became the stronger ones. In due time, it became known as Edom. What is the relationship? This is still pop quiz. We did this last time. What is the relationship between Esau and Jacob? They are brothers. They are brothers. They are twins. How far apart were they in birth? The distance of a hand on a heel. Okay? The distance of a hand on a heel. Who was first born? Esau. Who ended up with the rights of the firstborn? Jacob. These are brothers. What's the relationship between Edom and Israel in years to come? Not now. Years ahead as the Old Testament proceeds. The Bible is getting us ready for this. What's the relationship between Edom and Israel? They are brother nations. Okay? There's another country that's out here. You'll see it coming up. That's Moab. What's the relationship to Moab? This is Lot's family. Abraham's nephew is populating this. There is a very close relationship in history that's there. One of the ironies of our modern age is that has gone nowhere. All that is still right there. The relationship between the Jews and the Arabs in our day is still the relationship between brother nations. Only that brotherhood just is so hard to see. Now, what I want to do is take a little bit of time to hit a couple of highlights more. Take a look just for fun at verse 20. I'm looking at Genesis 36. This Genesis 36 is the story of Esau's descendants. Okay. Verse 20, this talks, I think, about the leaders of the country prior to the time Esau came in and his family began to be influential. These are the sons of Seir, the Horite. I said Hittite, it was Horite. Natives of the country. That is, they were already there. And if you come down to verse 24, you hear about one particular son, one particular descendant called Anah, A-N-A-H. What's he famous for? It's very interesting that this is in here, a little detail. He found a hot springs in the desert. Not supposed to be water in the desert. He found a spring, not just a spring, a hot spring. That'll keep you warm in the wintertime. And why did he find them? What was he doing? Looking for pasture for his daddy's donkeys. If you've been to the service today, you're going to talk about donkeys right at the end of the time. You might tie those things together. That section from verse 20 down to verse 30 tells you a list of the ones who were leaders, the kings or chieftains of that country prior to Esau coming in and his family taking lead. You know that because of what it says in verse 31. These are the kings who reigned in Edom before there was a king of Israelite descendants. Now, the Bible is, I think, looking back to the relationship between Esau and Jacob, not looking ahead to a time when a king like David would be in control of things. If you look from verse 9, still in chapter 36, down to about verse 19. These were the descendants of Esau who had the role of chieftains and kings and so forth. If you start counting them, there's a bunch of them. There's a bunch of them. God had said Esau would be a great nation, and he is. Already. At a time when Jacob has a small family, a few retainers, and a bunch of sons, Esau's got enough people in the country he comes from that he can take an army of 400 armed men and come after him. Now, it would be nice to end there and get on to Joseph, and I would really like to do that. But I need to take just a moment and take you somewhere else in Scripture. Let me remind you before I go here, everything that they're about to talk about has its parallel in Genesis 34. Genesis 34, last week, we saw what happened to Shechem when they offended Jacob's family. They wiped them out. It was genocide. They killed them out. The Bible later condemns Edom for the same thing. I didn't say last week, and I should have, if you go into the section where Moses was with the children of Israel coming out of Egypt, you remember the laws that they gave? Remember the laws that they got? One of those laws was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Jesus refined that himself in the New Testament. But why did that law come, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth? To try to stop the stuff that Genesis 34 describes. I just want to make sure I've made that touch point for you. All right. I want to take you to a little book called Obadiah. Good luck. Obadiah is one of the minor prophets. What does minor prophet mean? Small book. What does major prophet mean? Big book. Okay, so you have Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel. Those are the five big books. And from there to Matthew are the little bitty books. Amos, Obadiah, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah. So it's right before Jonah, right after Amos, I think.
Yes.
Okay. It is so short that we don't have to worry about chapters. We only have to worry about verses. Verse 1. A vision of Obadiah about Edom. Who's Edom? That's Esau's family. That's Esau's descendants. That's the country where Esau was in control. Verse 3. Your proud heart has misled you, God is saying to Edom. You whose home is in the crannies of the rock. The word rock in my translation is capitalized. Is that capitalized in yours?
No.
You who make the heights your dwelling. You who think to yourselves, who can bring me down to earth? Though you soar like an eagle, though you set your nest among the stars, I will bring you down from there, declares the Lord. When that day comes, this is verse 8, declares the Lord, I will eliminate sages from Edom. I will eliminate intelligence from Mount Esau. Your warriors will be so demoralized that the people of Mount Esau will be massacred to the last one. Why is this condemnation coming? Let me first of all give you a little bit of context. I think I said this last week. I want to make sure that I did. If you go to this part of the world today and you go into southwestern Jordan, you'll find a place called Petra. Petra is the heart of Edom. Petra, the capital city of Edom. And its ruins can be seen today. Pretty well preserved from what I hear. I have not seen them yet. It was in a mountainous area. They say that there are mountain passes that 15 men could probably hold against an army of 3,000. And God is speaking directly to that kind of attitude. Now, why are they being condemned? Look at verse 10. For the slaughter, for the violence done to your brother Jacob, shame will cover you and you will be annihilated forever. And what follows from verse 10 on is a series of stages or steps that Esau took when not Jacob, but the country that came from Jacob, Israel, was being pillaged by foreign armies. What did Edom do when it saw Israel under attack? Did they come to her aid? No. Did they simply stand aside? For a while, that's where it started. Now, I'm not going to do too much, but just look at the first phrase of verse 11. On the day when you stood aloof while strangers carried off his riches. The verse ends in my translation with, you were as bad as the rest of them. Verse 2, did you not feast your eyes on your brother on the day of his misfortune? Did you not gloat over the children of Judah on the day of their ruin? Did you not play the braggart on the day of his distress? Can you feel the stages coming? Did you not enter my people's gate on the day of their calamity? Did you not especially feast your eyes on their suffering on their day of calamity? Did you not touch their possessions on the day of their calamity? Did you not wait at the crossroads to annihilate their fugitives? Did you not hand over the survivors on the day of their distress? The end of verse 15, as you have done, so it will be done to you. Your deeds will recoil on your own head. Let's just track it. There's seven stages here. The calamity came and Edom stood aloof. Didn't come to their aid. Remember Cain's question of God? Where's your brother? Am I my brother's keeper? Number two, and the phrase here in, I think your translation might be, Edom looked down on his brother. Do you have that phrase? I have a note here that says, this is, I think, verse 12. One translation says, you looked down on your brother on the day of his misfortune. You gloated. Yeah. Gloated, I think, is a better one. It's either despised or, which might be interpreted as considered themselves stronger or wiser, or they showed a special curiosity. I want to take you for a moment to Galatians chapter 6. You don't need to go there, but if you're taking notes, you might want to write it down. Galatians number 6. Brothers, if one of you is caught doing something wrong, those of you who are spiritual should set that person right in a spiritual spirit of gentleness, and watch yourselves that you're not put to the test in the same way. Carry each other's burdens. That's the way you keep the law of Christ. Galatians 6, 1 and 2. They stood aloof and did nothing. They gloated over what was there. The second part of verse 12, mine in the first one says, feast your eyes on your brother. And then the second part of verse 12, they gloat over the children of Judah. And then last, they played the braggart. They looked down on them. They rejoiced over what was happening to them. And then they boasted, that would never happen to us. We're better than them. Look, can you feel the stages that were coming there? And then verse 13, what did they do? The attackers withdraw, and what happens? Edom attacks. What little they have left, Edom begins to pillage. They enter the gates, and they begin to take what little was left. And if that weren't enough, what else did they do? This, I think, is verse 14 now. A few people escaped. What did Edom do? Tracked them down and did what? Turned them over to the conquerors. There is a parallel between Genesis 34 and what Obadiah describes. Exactly what is Obadiah describing, that's a little tough to say. There's some passages in Chronicles that seem to line up with this. Certainly when the Babylonians came in, this is probably something that Edom did more than once. But most Bible scholars think that this was something that happened before the final end that Babylon brought. But here it is. What should have been brothers. And the question that comes, what do we do when our brothers fall? There is an attacker. There is one who does not wish us well. Satan does not want us to prosper. He certainly does not want us to prosper spiritually. He doesn't want our influence to be felt. And people fall. You hear the pastor talk this morning about the moment that seminary teacher put all these notes aside and just had a real stern talk. Remember what he said? Pray. I think I heard him say, pray that your desires and your opportunities don't coincide. Pray that that doesn't happen. So what happens when somebody falls? Is our response to pick them up? Or is our response to gloat? To brag about how we would never fall into that? There's a message here, and it's a pretty powerful message. I'm going to read a couple of verses out of the New Testament. I have some notes here that say these are good things to read. 1 Corinthians 14. He's talking about speaking in tongues, but here's the phrase. Let all these things be done in a way that builds up the community. The kinds of things that brothers do to brothers can build things up and they can tear things down. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 16. I'm going to start at verse 15. If we live by the truth and in love, we will grow completely into Christ, who is the head, by whom the whole body is fitted and joined together, every joint adding its own strength, each individual part working according to its function. That's the way the body grows until it has built itself up in love. That's the way brothers are supposed to work with each other. And we just read Galatians 6:1. If somebody does stumble, lift them up in gentleness, realizing you too could fall into that same trap. Now, I want to finish this by speaking about one other little thing. There is another word that I'd like you to put alongside of this. I think I'm spelling it correctly. Illumia. I-L-U-M-E-A. I think I have that spelled correctly. This was the name of the country in Jesus' day. Seir, which became Edom by Jesus' day, was known as Illumia. Probably because the Romans had conquered it and they had put their stamp on it. Okay? There are two very prominent kings in the life of Jesus. One is Herod the Great. What did Herod the Great do? When the wise men came and told him about the prophecies and he went back and looked at those, what did he do? He had all the male children in Bethlehem killed, and Jesus and his family had just barely gotten out to Egypt before that happened. When he died, a son came along, Herod Agrippa. Herod Agrippa, I think, is the one who had John the Baptist beheaded. He's the one Jesus spoke of as that fox. A very unusual thing for Jesus to say. He didn't say that about very many people. You know where Herod the Great was from? You know where Herod Agrippa was from? They were from Illumia. How very interesting. That even in Jesus' time, this old ancient rivalry is still playing out. When Jesus was crucified, what did Pilate have put on his cross? King of the Jews. What did the priests and the chief governmental people say? Why don't you put up there, he said he was king. What did Pilate say? What I have written, I have written. That old rivalry is still there. The echoes of it, the remnants of it. And it's important that we see this. Okay. We can finally get to Genesis 37.
Bill, do you mind going over the seven stages?
I will try. He stood aloof and did not help when the attackers came. Looked down on the Bible says, look down on your brother in the day of his misfortune. Rejoiced over the children of Judah in the days of their ruin. basically you saw your brother in peril and you were happy about it. Boasted on the day of your brother's distress, pride was beginning to come in. Entered the country on the day of calamity, feasting their eyes on their suffering. Took what little their brother had left, and then lay in wait to annihilate the fugitive and to hand over the survivors to the attackers. When I think about that list and when I think about that question, what do we do when our brothers get into distress? I cannot help but think about the prison ministry. There's an office just across the hall where a lot of the administration of that program comes out of. What do we do when people stumble and fall? I think it's a test of who we are and how we are following the Lord and how we do this. Jesus himself said one of the marks of whether or not you're saved is what you do when people are hungry, what you do when they're sick, what do you do when they're in prison, what do you do when people fall. So, back to Genesis 37. I want to go and take a look, first of all, at that first verse one more time. Jacob settles in the land of his father. The land of Canaan. And then I want to read the rest of the little beginning phrase. I think this is verse 2. In my translation, it's very short, and I believe it mistranslates it. My translation for verse 2 says, "This is the story of Joseph," and I don't think that's right. I don't think that's what it says. I think it says Jacob. "This is the story of Jacob," and all they talk about is Joseph. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing?
These are the records of the generations.
Yeah, and that phrase, you may remember, we have seen that phrase over and over through this book. So, this is the generations of Abraham. This was the generations of Isaac, so forth. The phrase here mentions Jacob, but the focus is on Joseph. And I want to try to help you understand that. I don't know that we are going to get much past verse 2 before we end this morning. I just want you prepared for that. But we are in chapter 37, and that's good. Okay? So here's my question. Can you, in your mind, based on what I hope you already know, I hope when you go through from 37 to the rest of this book, I hope you're going through territory that's familiar to you. We may see new details, we may see things we didn't see before, but the general outline, I hope that's familiar to you. How do you compare Joseph with Moses? How do you compare Joseph with Moses? Joseph was raised in a desert. Where did he serve? He served in a palace. Moses, raised in a palace, served in a desert. Interesting contrast. One running by God's will in one direction, one running by God's will in another direction, both of them ending up serving in extremely important ways. The early history of the nation of Israel is bookmarked by these two characters. Joseph to Moses is a passage in the Old Testament. It's a passage of that nation. The building of the nation, the coming together of the nation, all that. And these two great characters are at either end. Let's look a little closer at Joseph. I am assuming that you already know something about this. If you don't, then I'm going to be saying some things you don't understand, and you're going to have to go back and read 37, 38, 39, and 40 to get an idea of what we're talking about. He was loved and he was hated. Who loved him? His daddy did. Who hated him? His brothers did. He was favored and he was abused. Who favored him? Daddy did. Who abused him? Brothers did. He was trusted and he was tempted. Who trusted him? Potiphar first, Pharaoh later. Who tempted him? Potiphar's wife. Are you going to stop there? I don't think you stop there. I think you take one more step. I think his brothers tempted him. The day came, he had them in his power. And he could have done what he wished. And I think there was temptation there as well. He was abased and he was exalted. How was he abased? Sold into slavery. By whom? By his brothers. To whom? To whom? Be careful here. To the Ishmaelites. Who was Ishmael? Isaac's brother. Where were these particular Ishmaelites from? Midian. How does Midian figure in Moses' life? That's where he fled for those 40 years after he was in the palace. Who exalted him? Two answers, I think. Potiphar exalted him. Three answers. Pharaoh exalted him. And God exalted him.
So what was the opposite of the exalted?
Abased. Sold into slavery, later thrown into jail. Just for a second. Is there a parallel with Jesus here? When Jesus was crucified, who else was crucified that same day? Two criminals. One on his left, one on his right. What happened to those two criminals? One cursed him, and one said, "Remember me." And Jesus said, "You'll be with me today in paradise." When Joseph was in prison, who was with him? Two criminals. What happened to those two criminals? One died, one lived. And interesting little reversal here. Who says, "Remember me"? Joseph does. Joseph says, "Remember me." And what did the guy do? He forgot him for 3 years. And then he remembered. One more little thing, and I'm trying to get you ready so that when you start reading in here, you will have motivation to read a little further to see these things. When he was sold into slavery, he was sold to the Ishmaelites, who sold him in Egypt to Potiphar. Who was Potiphar? What was his role in life? The captain of Pharaoh's guard. He was the head of the bodyguards, or the head of the secret service, I guess you might say, of his day. Right? When Joseph was thrown in prison, where was that prison? In the house of the captain of the guard. I hope you've put it together. He went from being in charge of the whole house to living in the basement. More or less. What are the premier characters of Joseph that we need to be watching for? Number one, he seems never to have taken his eyes off of God. He seems never to have taken his eyes off of God. Adversity did not harden his character. When he was sold into slavery, he could have said, "Well, so much for following God. Look where it got me." And thirdly, prosperity did not ruin him. It did not blind him to others, even to those who had mistreated him. He was the same in public as he was in private. And there are very few characters then, and there are very few people now that you can say that about. There was no outward expression of the sinful nature he shared with all of us. His hungers, his drives seem to have been under near perfect control. And yet, he is not quoted in the New Testament. He is hardly mentioned in the New Testament. Isn't that odd? It's going to be part of our job to figure out why that is. The bookends of Israel, Moses quoted thousands of times, it seems like. Joseph quoted not at all, as far as I know, and hardly even mentioned. If you look, there's four mentions in the Old Testament. One is in Hebrews that spoke of his faith. One is this curious little thing, I think it's in Mark, when Jesus meets with the woman at the well. A little tidbit of information is dropped that we do not have anywhere in the Old Testament. Joseph owned land in Canaan. How did he own land in Canaan? His father gave him that land. And that is a huge clue as to part of what's going on here. When he was sold into slavery, what was the price? It isn't as perfect as it could have been. 20 pieces of silver, not 30. And the most important thing to spot about Joseph, and now I'm turning you loose on the rest of Genesis. You got to read the rest of Genesis to see how this happens. As with Jesus, so with Joseph. Satan's picture was, I'm going to kill the Messiah, and that will end it all. And the day Jesus died, I'm sure Satan thought, this is the day of my greatest triumph. And what happened? He rose from the grave, and everything Satan had tried to do was thwarted. The worst thing that could possibly happen became the best thing that's ever happened. Joseph himself said it at the end of his life. You're going to have to read a ways to get there. When he talked to his brothers, remember what he said? You meant it to me for evil. God meant it for good. The curious way that life pans out and plays out. Things that look awful today turn out later to be so significant. Now, I've told you before that some of what I'm doing, I'm stealing out of a commentary by a guy named James Montgomery Boyce, B-O-I-C-E. Three volumes on Genesis alone. This is my kind of guy. Okay? This is my kind of guy. I want to read you something. He's talking about Joseph, and the heading for this little section is the hand of God. There's another thing about the story of Joseph that we must highlight in this introduction. Joseph's story is a great example, perhaps the chief example in the whole of the Bible, of the benevolent providence of God, the doctrine that Romans 8:28 talks about. We know that in all things God works the good of those who love Him, those who have been called according to His purpose. The remarkable thing about the story of God's providence in Joseph's life is that God used such little things in a link of a chain of circumstances by which to exalt Joseph to prime minister of Egypt and thereby save his family. And then Boyce in his third paragraph says this, and I want to just read for a little while. Let me give you a personal example. Among my resources in preparing this study was a tape entitled Joseph in Prison, a sermon preached in 1951 by Donald Gray Barnhouse, a former pastor of 10th Presbyterian Church, wherever that is. Philadelphia? Yes, it is Philadelphia. I knew that. In his sermon, Barnhouse said he had recently taken part in a series of meetings in western Pennsylvania, and he told how those meetings had come about. The story was of remarkable circumstances. It seems that some years before, a certain doctor had done medical work at the University of Pennsylvania and began to attend 10th Presbyterian Church with his wife and young son. The doctor and his wife became Christians through hearing Barnhouse preach and then grew in faith during the years of the doctor's further training, internship, and residency. The family was caught up in World War II and they left. When the war was over, the family settled in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, where the doctor established a surgical practice. They joined a church, and he taught a Bible class. Then he persuaded his minister to invite Barnhouse to his city for a series of meetings. The invitation broadened to include the members of the ministerial union of McKeesport, and eventually the meetings grew to fill the largest church in town. Barnhouse, in his remarks, marveled at how a medical student had walked into a Philadelphia church on one Sunday. And as a result of that, 10 or 12 years later, a multitude of people in McKeesport were hearing the gospel and hundreds were being blessed. That's the way Barnhouse ended his story, Boyce says. But there is more which he could not have known, but which continued as circumstances continued to be guided by God. That doctor and his wife had a son who attended 10th Presbyterian Church with them while they were in Philadelphia. During the meetings to which Barnhouse referred, that son, who was then 13 years old, had an intensifying of his call to the ministry. Unknown to Barnhouse, those meetings had a formative influence on his understanding of what ministry should be. He went to high school with that call in mind, on to college, on to seminary, always making choices regarding his plan of study on the basis of a perceived call to Christian service. Seminary was followed by study abroad. The young minister then went to Washington, D.C., took a position with Christianity Today magazine. There were some problems with the magazine in those days, and some of the staff spent a Saturday afternoon talking them over with a former associate editor, Dr. Frank Gabelin. In an aside comment during the conversation, Gabelin asked the doctor's son what he wanted to do with his life. Did he want to continue doing editorial work for a magazine, or was he looking forward to doing something else? The doctor's son replied that he had been in training for the ministry and expected God to call him to a city church someday. That was the end of the conversation. But as it happened, Gabelin was traveling to Philadelphia the next day to preach in 10th Presbyterian Church, where the pulpit had recently become vacant. He was met at the train station by a member of the pulpit committee. "Have you found a minister for your church yet?" "No," was the answer. Gabelin replied he thought he had somebody, and he recommended the doctor's son. In 1968, 17 years after those meetings, nearly 30 years after the doctor's conversion, that son was called to the pastorate of Barnhouse's own church in Philadelphia. And Boyce writes, "I am that son. That doctor was my father. This is my story." What's your story? Let me tell you mine. In 1968, I was 1 year into graduate school, and the Department of Defense, in collusion with the Congress, decided that the draft should be ended for people who were in graduate school, and they grandfathered in those who had had 2 years of graduate studies, and they released those who had less than 2 years. I had finished 1 year of graduate school. I got a draft notice. I was 1A. I appealed because I had attended a school that didn't graduate students. Some of you don't know this. The school I went to when I was a freshman, freshmen were all it had. They added second class the next year when I was a sophomore. Barbara was in that class. She was a freshman. When I was a junior, I had taken all the classes they had pretty much in mathematics, physics, and chemistry. I had enough hours to graduate. I graduated with enough hours that about 5.5 years of college was the equivalent. But they graduated no students. So I stayed an extra year. During that year, I went to the University of Arkansas for 3 or 4 months. I went to Argonne National Laboratory in Chicago for 4 or 5 months. I worked at Exxon for 3 or 4 months. And then I started graduate school. So I appealed to my draft board. I said, "My Lord, I've been doing graduate work for over 2 years. I drove to Houston. I met with my draft board. And these guys, when I got finished, I think there was one woman and 4 men, they shook my hand. They said, "You have convinced us. We're going to make you, whatever it was, 1D. We're going to leave you alone. You can expect to have us call when you finish your graduate program." I said, "Thank you." I went home. 2 weeks later, maybe a week and a half later, I get a letter from my draft board. I'm declared 1A. I picked up the phone. I made a phone call. The woman who answered the phone said, "Yeah, me and Gladys, we was talking about it, and we decided the draft board made a mistake, so we reclassified you 1A. You can expect to be drafted in 2.5 weeks. I don't want to tell you what I felt like on that day. Back up a year, I started at Florida with a National Science Foundation fellowship. I didn't have to do teaching. And I went to them and said, "But I want to be a teacher. And you've got great teachers here. I want to learn from them." Person after person said, "Have you lost your mind? Have you lost your mind? You don't have to teach. That's the whole purpose of the scholarship." But I taught anyway. I went to talk to the department chair. The department chair says, "Are you trying to get out of the Army?" "No, I just want to finish my degree first." He says, "Okay." He hired me as an instructor. I was on the faculty for my second year, what would have been my second year of graduate school, I was on the faculty at the University of Florida. My job was to teach general chemistry to a class of 400 freshmen and to teach all the incoming graduate students how to be teaching assistants in the labs and in the recitation sections. That was my job for a year. It turned out he had been agonizing that day. Somebody was going on sabbatical. They thought they had a replacement. The replacement had fallen through. He hired me. That gave me a work deferment for 1 year, and that put me in ROTC the next year. So that I did go into the military, but I went in on my terms and not on the terms of Gladys and her friend Edith. I finished my graduate program. I walked across the stage. I headed to Alabama, and I went to basic officer course. Most summers, that's when research gets its biggest push. Most summers, I was at either Fort Bragg or some other place doing military stuff. And then I started applying for jobs. And I applied for a job at the University of Richmond. University of Richmond guy picked up the phone, I found out 10 years later, and called that department chairman down at Florida. And they said, tell us about this guy. And he said, let me just tell you what he did his second year as a graduate student. And he told that story. There were 450 applicants for the position I got at Richmond. I got that job because I had worked at Florida for my second year in the way that I did. I did that because I got drafted, or almost got drafted. I did that because of that awful, horrible day when I thought the world had collapsed. What can be the worst can turn out to be the best. That's my story. What's yours? That's not the only story I have. That's the most dramatic, I think. I like the story that Boyce tells. I like the way it ends. I am that son. That is my story. You're about to embark on Joseph's story, one of the best in the Old Testament. And the heart of this is, what happens when the world crushes you again and again and again, and yet you know the Lord? There is an example set out for us, and it's one of the best examples I can tell you. We haven't passed verse 2, but we have started. Joseph is somebody we want to be like. And yet, God chose somebody else as the one to make the line that went to the Messiah through. So we're going to have to work all that out. I invite you to come back. Let's see how this unfolds. Let's have a word of prayer before we go. Our Father, we thank you for Joseph. We thank you for other examples. And we thank you that we can look back in our own lives and see tough and hard times that you have found a way to turn to something that's good and something that's productive in your kingdom. Help us understand that keeping our eyes on you, learning from you, being obedient to you is the best way to live. And let us see in Joseph's life the way to do it. I pray all this in your son's name.